President, I should start by apologising for my appearance. I'm quite sure that the cohort effect will have something about domestic accidents inflicted on themselves by the DIY generation. And I'm sure that that will be fading out in due course as we cull ourselves off. The authors state that they've had access to data from GAD and the ONS and from Professor Sir Richard Doll's British Doctors study, and I'd like to just refer back to the fact that when we discussed longevity in the 21st century last year, that Professor Sir Richard Doll was here, aged 92, and gave a very strong contribution and provided us with information to that, and we're very sorry that he died and was unable either to come to our ageing population conference, where he would have been particularly somebody to listen to and to this meeting. We're told that there are £1.5 trillion worth of pension fund liabilities, and yet the profession has only recently been able to get its hands on industry-wide data on the mortality of pensioners in self-administered pension schemes, and that data collection is at risk due to lack of funding. And I think we should be calling on the government to provide funding to give us the data that we need for mortality investigations. Neil Robjohns referred to the wide number of different organisations involved in understanding mortality developments, and the profession can, as one of them, be proud of the leading role it's played and continues to play in this area. It should be said that the cross-fertilisation of ideas between the different initiatives, as a number of actuaries and others play a major part in a number of different studies, is, I think, particularly helpful. And in view of the continuing public interest in mortality developments and the profession's level of expertise in this area, I wish to propose that mortality developments should become a theme for the profession's research efforts and funding, a special theme. This theme should encompass three specific areas for future research: understanding the past, projection methodologies, and projecting the future. Some very good work is going on in all three of those areas, but I believe there's scope for more. Some of this can continue to go on in the old way, by actuaries working in their own time or their employer's time, and possibly with academics, and basically at no expense to the profession apart from publishing and discussing papers. However, I think other work will require funding from the research committee or elsewhere, and if we're to see a greater involvement with other professions, then we've probably got to see a lot more development from the funded route. Understanding the past, in considering today, we've seen some really excellent work in understanding the cohort effect. Some of this work already draws on developments in other professions, such as medicine, epidemiology, and demographics. However, new areas of research are coming up, do need to be tackled, and I believe that that should be item one. Item two, I think, should be projection methodologies, and the CMI and others have highlighted other areas where they would like to see further work on projection methodologies. And the third area is projecting the future. There are exciting opportunities here to work with other professions to better understand the environmental, social, and medical factors that may in future contribute to improvements or worsening of population and life assured pension and mortality. Again, the profession has experts in the field who've contributed strongly to our understanding and has further work in progress. However, there are new developments in surgical and medical advances and in longevity-enhancing drugs, on understanding infectious diseases, and a variety of other issues that do need to be understood. And whereas I think there's an overlap between the three areas I've mentioned, I do think it's worth just making the distinction and putting them up and then getting down to it. And my basic proposal is that the profession should adopt mortality developments as a research theme, allocate potential funding for further work, hopefully in conjunction with some government-funded research organisation, publish a challenging prospectus, and ask for research proposals in line with the prospectus. This will be a high-profile initiative, working with other professions in a multidisciplinary research area, and it would probably involve a top-level cross-professional group to define the direction and to assess whether the areas that might be covered are of sufficient interest to deserve the funding. In conclusion, I'd like to thank the speakers for a very challenging and interesting paper and for raising so many other areas that we can now be looking at.
Any other contributions? If not, while you're all thinking, I shall use the chairman's prerogative to make a few remarks myself. I particularly welcome the emphasis in the paper on uncertainty of future projections of mortality. All actuarial work involves projections into the future, and the future is unknown and inherently uncertain. And there are two sorts of uncertainty, as the paper explains. We use past and present data to identify trends, recent trends, and then use those as a basis to project forward. But the data isn't straightforward. It's full of what we call background noise. And so we may not correctly identify the trends to project forward. That's one type of uncertainty, and I think this paper makes a significant contribution to addressing that in the area of mortality. The other type of uncertainty is that the future will inevitably turn out differently from our projections. It always does, and it always will do. The CMI's published some recent working papers which have addressed these two types of uncertainty. And interestingly, I spent 2 days last week at the convention for our general insurance actuaries, and I doubt if there are very many here in the audience. I've spotted one from last week, because general insurance actuaries tend not to get involved in mortality. But they were also discussing uncertainty when setting reserves for future claims against insurance companies. And they also identified exactly the same two types of uncertainty, and it formed a major part of the discussions at that convention. So this is something that is relevant right across the actuarial work that we do. I'd also like to mention briefly the question of disclosure, which Stephen Richards raised. The profession strongly supports transparency in all that we do. We have for many, many years had a requirement that reports from actuaries on pensions issues to trustees of pension schemes include full details of the assumptions, including the mortality assumptions. But we have no power to insist that the trustees pass on that information to the general public. On the question of accounting standards, the disclosure requirements are laid down by the Accounting Standards Board and not by the profession. But we would again support transparency there. And in future, as some of you may have noticed, we'll have a slightly closer relationship with the Accounting Standards Board than we have in the past. But we need to give careful thought as to the form of that disclosure. In a recent Financial Times article, Norma Cohen suggested that we did need a simple measure of life expectancy which would enable the intelligent layman to compare the assumptions being made for different companies in their published accounts. Now, one such simple measure might be the life expectancy of a man aged 65. And one can see attractions in that as being a simple comparative measure. But there are some dangers. Having a simple measure like that implies that there's a single right answer. And that brings me right up against my earlier remarks about uncertainty. So we need to think very carefully about this. As I said earlier, the profession does strongly support the idea of transparency, but we need to think carefully about what it is we communicate and how we communicate it. Thank you. Given anybody else time to have a think about what they might like to contribute to our discussion. Well, if there are no more contributions, then I will ask Dave Grimshaw if he'd like to close the discussion for us.
Thank you, Mr. President. In closing the discussion, I would like to offer a few comments of my own, or at least I did until the President just made them more eloquently than I would have done, and also attempt to comment on some of the strands of this evening's discussion. I will apologise in advance if I misrepresent any of the previous speakers. Firstly, though, I'd like to add my thanks to those of the previous speakers, to the authors, for their paper and for the opportunity to discuss a subject that is at the core of much of the work of our profession. At the risk of offending Mr. Richards, I would like to express particular thanks to Dr. Curry and Mr. Kirkby for sharing their expertise and experience with our profession, both through tonight's paper and through their extensive work in recent years with the CMI. In a similar vein, whilst acknowledging all members of the profession who have contributed to tonight's discussion, I would like to express particular thanks to Professor Kuhl and the speakers from outside the profession for their insights. Although I'd never be able to listen to Blondie's Parallel Lines again in quite the same vein. Actuaries have a particular role in assessing the financial implications of mortality and longevity, but we cannot plough this particular furrow alone, and I'll return to that aspect later. It is, as a number of speakers have commented, a very topical subject, whether in the context of insurance companies' pricing and reserving for annuities, of private sector pension scheme funding, or of wider social issues such as retirement ages in the public sector. In his paper to the Institute in 1981, The Flock and the Sheep and Other Essays, Frank Reddington observed, "We may make history, but history makes us. We all have blind spots, and they can remain undetected for decades and even centuries. Sooner or later, however, the probing fingers of history, like those of a physician, alight upon the source of the trouble. And afterwards we become different people. In these recent turbulent years, the fingers of history have been probing more deeply than before and have effected a quiet but deep revolution in our attitudes." Mr. Reddington was referring to the substantial changes in investment conditions with which actuaries at that time had to contend. However, it appears to me that in the context of mortality, the current cohort of actuaries may feel that the fingers of history are pointing at them. The CMI and many of its members independently have undertaken much valuable research into mortality recently, but there is much more that could be done, and Mr. Ridsdale suggested earlier that there was a need for government funding to support this. One particular area where more could be done is of analyses into mortality of self-administered pension schemes, which the CMI has recently started investigating. Early results show significant differences between industry group, an important consideration if, as the President just alluded to, pension schemes are to properly understand their individual position and to disclose this. Important too, if we are to inform public debate, press reports during the recent quite public debate between the government and Unison over public sector retirement ages quoted one union official as saying that mortality improvements affected the fat cat bosses, not the ordinary members. I would also suggest that with such a wide range of professions interested in the topic, that there is a great need for coordination of the research effort and a forum to encourage cross-fertilisation between the disciplines. And this coordination is perhaps an area for our profession to take a lead. On the subject of cross-disciplinary cooperation, I was surprised to read today in an article from last week's British Medical Journal that few studies have evaluated the effect of early retirement on survival. No mention was made of actuarial publications, yet the seemingly groundbreaking results from this particular analysis will have come as no surprise to anyone who has read any of the CMI reports comparing early and normal pensioner mortality. I say this not to deride the work summarised in the paper, and I confess I got no further than the introduction this morning, but to raise the question of whether we are promoting our knowledge and expertise to the full with other professions. Incidentally, a beneficial side effect of greater collaboration could be increased peer review of our work by others. However, if we are to play a fuller role, then we will need to be clearer about the message that we as a profession offer to the wider world. Three of the last four press releases issued by the UK actuarial profession relate to mortality improvements. The latest, in advance of tonight's paper, is entitled Actuaries Predict Further Improvements in Mortality at Older Ages. The first of the three, issued in conjunction with the Ageing Population Conference early in September, was entitled Leading Ageing Expert Warns Government Not to Assume Improving Mortality. It was the middle of the three press releases that I think best summarises our current position, and I do stress these are in the titles of the press releases, but the middle one was Actuarial Profession Highlights Need to Allow for Uncertainty in Future Mortality. There is no doubt that actuaries have consistently underestimated mortality improvements in the past, presumably in the belief that such fast rates of improvement could not continue, when, in fact, they have been successively exceeded. However, I have a personal concern that a new orthodoxy might emerge to the effect that such fast rates of improvement will continue or even accelerate. This paper and the recent change in approach by the GAD appear to point in this direction. Yet, as some of the previous speakers have noted, all we can be certain of in this area is uncertainty. Of course, recent observed trends can be expected to continue in the short term. But after that, none of us knows what the impact of pandemics, global warming and obesity will be. Even if they do not lead to deteriorating mortality, they surely have the potential to slow down rates of improvement. One direction in which this uncertainty around future mortality seems to be leading is for institutions to shun this risk. Mr. Richards spoke earlier of pension scheme deficits and, in a quote, the slow, agonising death of defined benefits. Yet what are the social ramifications of transferring this risk to the individual? If the risk is unacceptable to an institution, what hopes does an individual have for sensible financial planning? Much of the paper in sections 3, 4 and 5 take the reader through the process of fitting curves to past mortality data, starting with moving averages through kernels to p-splines. I found this to be well written, whilst acknowledging one or two gaps that Mr. Rob Johns pointed to earlier, and illustrates how the increased complexity of p-splines actually draws on a relatively straightforward base. It would be particularly valuable to any actuary approaching the subject as a result of the CMI's recent working papers, which perhaps leap straight into the deep end with p-splines. However, returning to my theme of external perceptions, there were several aspects of the paper that I felt capable of misinterpretation. As early as section 1.2, the authors state, the year of birth proves to be a strong explanatory factor for the patterns of mortality improvement in the United Kingdom. This is undoubtedly true in a statistical sense of the word explanatory, but not perhaps in an everyday context. We still seek the underlying explanation of these effects, as noted in the paper and earlier discussion, and I'll mention briefly, slightly later, the work of Gavrilov and Gavrilova. In section 5.13, the paper states, we conclude that year of birth gives a stronger signal than year of observation in a model of mortality. Again, taken in the context of UK data during the period of analysis, I take no issue with this at all, but taken alone, it can certainly be taken out of context. And Professor Wilkie earlier highlighted some of the periods during which it hasn't applied. My third and final cautionary note relates to section 6.6 and has been referred to earlier by Mr. Rob Johns. I have myself tried to explain confidence intervals around mortality projections and found it very difficult. The authors correctly state that these confidence intervals critically assume that the assumed model is the appropriate one. But we know it cannot be the correct model. We can only hope that it does not prove to be too incorrect. What then does that say about a confidence interval, and how do we explain that to the outside world? Mr. Leandro referred earlier to the successive retrospective fitting of the current methodology to data through the 1990s. This can, of course, give us comfort, but we must expect further shocks to the methodology in the future. We may not be able to predict when these step changes will occur or even the direction of the change, but as a profession we need to develop solutions that are robust and adaptable in the face of these changes. Much research is going on into the reasons why mortality has improved at such rates. A recent paper by Gavrilova and Gavrilov has focused on centenarians, more plentiful in the US than here, of course, to investigate exceptional human longevity. Their research suggests that birth order, family size, and month of birth are important factors for mortality in later life. In particular, they suggest that firstborn children, and especially firstborn daughters for some reason, experience lighter mortality. If this is true, then of itself, a fall in or a change in the size of an average family could drive through mortality improvements as a greater proportion of the population fall into the firstborn category. Moreover, such a finding could help to explain differences in the rate of improvement. Much has been made of the cohort effect in UK data, and similar effects have been observed in population data from France and Germany. Yet there does not seem to be a corresponding effect in the US. Perhaps international analysis of birth rates and family size would yield useful insights for mortality improvements. Several speakers tonight have commented on the effects of smoking on mortality and in explaining the cohort effect. Mr. Richards stated in his opening comments, I think, that lifelong non-smokers cannot benefit from giving up something they never did in the first place. Yet yesterday lunchtime I was faced with an NHS advert advising people to steer away from smokers, even if they're not smokers themselves. And this is surely one of the drivers towards smoke-free public venues. This effect appears to have been admitted by Mr. Willetts too in his comments earlier, where he referred to three components. If I could just try and pick up on a couple of other threads of the discussion tonight. I was interested in Mr. Lewin's comment that the data, querying the relevance of the data set to pension schemes and life insurers, whilst at the same time drawing analogies from Dutch annuitants in the 1600s. That there are definitely issues with the data sets, and one of the advantages to my mind of the CMI data set is that to an extent we do understand the issues better than perhaps we do as actuaries with the ONS data sets, although clearly that's an area where others can inform us. Mr. Turvey referred to not collecting smoker and non-smoker data for annuitants and pensioners, and that is certainly an issue that the CMI is currently trying to correct with its move to per policy data for the mortality investigations. However, I think there will always be a question mark around that until such time as smoking is used as a rating factor as to how good quality the data is. And I think, if I can just conclude, Benjamin Franklin said in 1789, "In this world, nothing can be said to be certain except death and taxes." Perhaps now this would have to be restated to, "Nothing can be said to be certain except uncertainty and taxes." Thank you.
Right, I'd now like to invite Ian Curry to respond to the discussion.
Mr. President, ladies and gentlemen, first of all, I'd like to thank all the contributors. You've been remarkably kind. I was expecting to be given that we'd be given a much harder ride than we have, so thank you very much for letting us down nicely. I'd like to make a few preliminary remarks before I respond to some of the points in tonight's discussion. First, I stand before you as a statistician, not as an actuary. I have no particular expertise as far as annuities and pension planning is concerned, so I hope you will forgive me if I do not comment in detail on some of the more actuarial points raised in the discussion. Moreover, the Financial Services Act forbids me from doing so. The statistician brings a different set of priorities to this problem, perhaps a different set of fears. I worry that predicting mortality accurately up to 50 years ahead is quite simply impossible, without a huge slice of luck. It is not the quality of the forecast method that is the problem. The damned target will be buffeted by medical advances, a plus. Improving living standards, a plus. Obesity, a minus. A poor diet, a minus. a lack of exercise, a minus. New diseases, another minus. We could go on. Quite how all these and other unknowns will affect future mortality is a $64 billion question. So when I approach the forecasting problem, my principal concern is to measure the uncertainty in any forecast. We do this in Figure 18 of the present paper, and the Working Paper 15 of the CMI Mortality Committee gives some other ways, using different models, of assessing uncertainty in future estimates of mortality. This leaves you with a problem. You have to price an annuity or pension. Part of the pricing depends on the unknown future mortality. You have to find a way of taking the measurable uncertainty in future mortality forecasts and quantifying this uncertainty in terms of financial risk. You've done it before with problems caused by variable rates of interest. I'm sure you can do it again with problems caused by unknown future mortality. Now, if I may turn briefly to individual contributions. Mr. Rob Johns made a nice distinction between the three of us as mountaineers and himself as a mariner. So, as coming from Scotland, I think we're more inclined to go for the mountaineering comparison. You were also worried that we didn't identify troughs in the cohort pattern. It seemed to us that perhaps for the present audience it's the peaks that have the greater insurance interest. We're also a little bit worried about our rather cavalier attitude to filling in missing values. If I can just throw in a little bit of technicality here, what the P-spline method does is to use a cubic interpolation scheme, so it's not really rocket science. When describing the method of P-splines, we were acutely conscious that we were trying to describe a method with which very few of you would be familiar. So we had to face the problem of how much do we tell you. We could have written a paper twice as long as this, and I'd like to think it wouldn't have been as effective. Of course, we have inevitably had to miss out a few things. We didn't make any great discussion of what the BIC value, which is the key to how we choose the smoothing parameter. There are references in the paper for you to learn more about this, but basically what we are trying to do is to try and balance fit, which would indicate you wanted a complex model, with smoothness, which would indicate you would want a simple model. And BIC is just one way of trying to do this. If I could just make one general comment about the difference between using what one might like to think of as a scientific method like BIC and doing it subjectively, that the human brain has a wonderful, wonderful capacity for seeing pattern, particularly when it's not there. The BIC values, Mr. Wilkie, said that there's some connection with chi-squared values, so I do assure you that the difference quoted in the paper is very substantial and does indicate that the cohort model is a better fitting model than the period model. Mr. Rob Johns also made some reference to a model that perhaps didn't continue with linear trends forevermore. And he would be looking for a model with some reversion. Now, of course, there are other methods, namely time series methods, that will do this kind of thing, and this is already described in the Mortality Committee working paper number 15. And, of course, we accept fully that confidence intervals are always conditional on the model, and our answer to this point is to say, well, if you don't like this model, and you shouldn't, you should try some other models. It's only by having a look at a wide range of models, all of which will have good things and bad things, that you begin to get some sort of feel for how uncertain the forecasts are going to be. We've also done some backtesting, and that's covered in one of the papers. Professor Koo I was quite dismayed when you put up your graph, your initial graph, because I felt that it showed what we had been labouring to show so much more clearly. I wasn't quite sure that I understood you correctly. You were saying that the 1931 cohort does very well, but the 1939 cohort does not do so well. I think the point here is that the rate of improvement is much less for 1939. Of course, if you're going to choose which mortality table you would like to follow, you would definitely go for 1939. It's not improving so quickly, but it is better. Also, I inject a slightly personal note here. I noticed that your survey of manual and non-manual individuals used individuals from March 1946. So I should declare an interest here. I'm not part of this survey, despite the fact that I'm, in fact, eligible. Richard Willetts highlighted the 3.5% to 4% improvements. These strike me as very dramatic figures indeed, but there's a lot of evidence in the past for improvements of this kind of rate. And there's also been, one of the themes of the discussion has been how we can perhaps introduce other factors. Smoking has been a big one that's been mentioned. Also, medical advances. How can you introduce these into a model? Well, one comment here is, of course, that none of the data that we had available actually had this information to hand. So all we can say is that the past is the best guide for the future that we have. And I think it's figure 17 where we show the forecasts for all ages and 10-year age bands. If you look at that figure, if you're reasonably comfortable with it, then you're reasonably comfortable with the idea of a linear forecast. David Wilkie took issue with us for using a model with 200 parameters. Claimed to be able to do things with a model with only 5 parameters. A couple of things to say about this. First of all, our model certainly has 200 free parameters, but by the time we've imposed smoothing on it, the effective number of parameters is greatly reduced. The other thing to say, I think, is that the model, the P-spline model, is a genuine two-dimensional model. It will respond to the local movements anywhere in the mortality data set. Now, that cannot be the case for a model with only 5 parameters, which is going to impose a particular functional form on the data set. So we do think that this two-dimensional approach that we have offers a very sensitive way of modelling two-dimensional mortality. Of course, it's quite a different thing to then go on to use this model, which has done so well on the data, to use it to forecasting, and that's indeed is quite a bit more controversial. Tony Andrew was very kind in some of his remarks about how good that our model was at removing noise and to reveal a deeper pattern, and that just echoes the comments that I just made for a moment or two. Now, the CMI are busy testing our model to destruction, I think. There are a very large number of parameters that need to be set in this model, and I think we need to be a little more careful in giving guidance as to what models are, what parameter settings are acceptable and what are not so wise. Chris Lewin pointed out that we admit that our confidence intervals are wide. I would put it much more strongly than that. I would say that we are proud that our confidence intervals are wide. Peter Turvey took someone to task, I think for, I can't remember whom, for failing to collect data and suggest that we should be taking urgent steps to put this right by collecting at least data on smokers and non-smokers. Of course, it will take quite considerable time to build up a database from there. Mr. Ribsdale, I couldn't help laughing when he made some comments about mortality funding. I must send in my bill. But, of course, James Kirkby, as it's mentioned in the acknowledgements, is in receipt of government funding, and he is on an EPSRC PhD scholarship with further support from the CMI. So I fully agree that this is really just scratching the surface here. I think he also used the expression, no expense to the profession, which is, I think I don't need to say any more about that. Both the President and Mr. Grimshaw in their final remarks were picking up constantly on the uncertainty of future forecasts. Now, this is something we've made no attempt to hide. And in fact, as I've said just a moment or two ago, this is something that we are proud of, that we have tried to introduce to the profession a way of measuring future uncertainty. So could I just finish by thanking you all again for taking the trouble to read our paper and for paying such close attention and for your kind remarks. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Ian. I think we've had a good discussion. With the exception of my own remarks, I think what we lacked in quantity, the contributors made up by quality. Neil Robjohns and Brian Ridsdale mentioned some of the other things that we've been doing as a profession in this area. And I would like to make a plug at this point for the series of seminars we've been holding here, jointly organised with the International Longevity Centre, which has been running for some 4 years now, on covering a wide range of ageing population issues. So keep your eye open for announcements of those. They are well worth attending, I can assure you. It now only remains for me to express my own thanks, and I'm sure the thanks of all of us, to our three authors, to our opener and closer, and to all the contributors. Thank you all very much. I'd like to draw your attention to the fact that we now have a bulletin board that's been set up on our website, which is available after each of our sessional meetings. And anyone wishing to comment on the paper or on any part of the discussion can post their comments on the bulletin board on the website. It can be accessed by the forum heading on the top navigation bar as you enter the website. It would also be very helpful for those preparing the transcript of the discussion if those of you who had prepared notes could hand them a copy to either Pauline or Maria at the back of the hall as you leave. Finally, I'd like to announce the next sessional meeting with the Institute of Actuaries will take place at 5:30 p.m. on Monday the 28th of November, when a discussion on background, pensions and risk is scheduled to take place. And please note the change of start time for this meeting will be 5:30, not 5 o'clock. Tea will be served from 5 p.m. Right, I declare the meeting closed.